we've learned anything from these past couple of years, my fellow Americans, it's that personal medical freedom and liberty are in crisis. America Out Loud Pulse brings together the top experts in healthcare-related fields to keep you a beat ahead.
People who live out in the country are Americans too. Let's never forget that. I'm Marilyn Singleton, and welcome to America Out Loud Pulse, always a beat ahead. Almost 20% of the U.S. population is spread across 97% of the land area. Rural hospitals and rural patients have been largely neglected in articles about medical health and healthcare policy. And we always hear about these committees and programs for rural health, but the patients in the countryside continue to lack great care. What is going on? We've had nursing homes closed or merge. There's about 10% of counties out in the country with no nursing homes at all. What's happening to these aging Americans? And unbelievably, since 2010, more than 137 rural hospitals have closed. So these folks have nowhere to go near their homes. And the hospitals are running out of money. There seems to be a disproportionate number of opiate problems in these communities. What are doctors and patients to do? Close the hospital? Sell out? Today, we are going to discuss these issues and more. My guest, Dr. Edwin Leap, is an emergency physician and writer. He graduated from Marshall University with a BS in zoology, completed his medical degree at West Virginia University School of Medicine, and his emergency medicine residency at Methodist Hospital of Indiana. He has practiced emergency medicine for over 25 years and currently practices in Southern Appalachia in a small to medium-sized emergency room. He does have a special interest in the struggles of these small facilities. And by the by, Dr. Leap also served as a U.S. Air Force officer and flight surgeon in the Reserve and National Guard units in West Virginia, Indiana, and South Carolina. He also is an award-winning columnist and blogger who has written for The Huffington Post, Politico, The Atlantic, and MedPage Today. And he's authored two books, if that wasn't enough, The Practice Test and Life in Emergistan. Welcome to Pulse, Dr. Leap.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be here. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here and to discuss these issues, which are really, really near and dear to my heart.
Well, it sure sounds like it. How long have you been working out in the countryside?
So here's my career trajectory. I finished residency, then took a job in a medium-sized sort of semi-rural hospital where I worked with a private group. Actually, it was a fee-for-service group for 20 years. Then in 2013 or so, I decided I just needed a change, and I started to do locums. And part of the locums I did ended up being in critical access hospitals and other small rural hospitals. And not only that, but largely that. And as you know, those are places that have about 25 inpatient beds that are generally at least 30 minutes or more to referral centers and other hospitals, in other areas, that is. And so during the course of that time, over the last, 2013 to now, I've worked in South Carolina, North Carolina, Kentucky, Georgia, Illinois, Indiana, Colorado, and West Virginia. And I say that because I think it gives me a great cross-section of the country, mostly southern Appalachia, but there's also these other places in the Midwest that really struggled as well. And so in the course of that, I've just seen so much. I've worked with wonderful people. I've taken care of amazing patients. I've seen crazy, fascinating cases. But I've also learned that really, really, in those places, healthcare is struggling. And right now it's struggling perhaps worse than it ever has.
Well, what kind of illness?
Oh, what I've seen. Go ahead.
What kind of illnesses conditions and patients do you see?
You know, rural America is, as you mentioned in the intro, underserved in many ways. And one of those has been primary care. And so in rural America, we see a lot of unregulated, poorly managed diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, of course, lung disease from tobacco and work in the coal mines and the cotton mills. We see a lot of renal failure, a lot of dialysis dependent patients, a lot of malignancies across the board. We see kidney disease of other sorts. And in particular in the South, we see so many kidney stones that often end up with patients septic from infected stones. So we also see trauma. I mean, we see things as divergent as ATV wrecks or falls, or of course, not really trauma, but snake bites, other sorts of things like that really require advanced care. You know, people who work in the logging industry, people who work in the mines, they have very dangerous jobs. And those things end up in small departments smaller emergency departments, because they're hours to big centers sometimes. I mean, literally 2 hours. I remember working in Colorado one day and having a heart attack patient, a STEMI, an ST elevation MI. And we gave him thrombolytics. He had a brief cardiac arrest and we shocked him out of that. We had to fly him by fixed wing to the nearest referral center that had a cardiac cath lab, by fixed wing, not helicopter. And so we really see across the board so much pathology. And what fascinates me and really gets under my skin is when I talk to people in academia, in emergency medicine training programs, and so often I've heard people say, they say this thing, they say, well, we encourage our residents not to go to rural areas because they'll simply lose their skills. And having worked in rural America, I can tell you that's absolutely untrue. In fact, we'll use your skills more than ever, because there is no anesthesiologist to back you up with the airway. There is no trauma surgeon to back you up with the line of the chest tube. It all falls to the physician in the emergency department, typically. Whether it's the precipitous delivery, the septic child, all these things come to the door. And in big centers, they would result in the activation of teams, trauma teams, pediatric resuscitation teams, all sorts of resources would come to bear. The cath lab would open up. This doesn't happen in the critical access hospitals. This doesn't happen 2 hours from any referral center. And it certainly didn't happen during COVID, when not only were these people facing their typical problems, but there were no beds to send them to, nowhere. We were making phone calls to transfer the critical hospitals in concentric circles out from wherever I was working, whether that was in the Carolinas or elsewhere. I mean, there was no place to send people. And if you did find a bed, there was not an ambulance to take them, because the ambulance would have to leave the county for a full day sometimes to go that distance. This is problematic. And it seems to be acceptable somehow in the medical administration and those who serve the powers that be in medicine. It's just like, well, if you live in rural America, that's just a chance you take. And yet these are American citizens. These are people who deserve care because they produce food, they produce energy. And even if they didn't, they're still our citizens. So I'm sort of flabbergasted by the rather laissez-faire attitude we have towards this. And you mentioned, you know, private equity. As large hospitals buy small hospitals, they offer them the world, right? Oh, we'll be available for all your referrals. You can send your complex patients, you can send your STEMIs, you can send your sepsis, you can send your trauma, your orthopedic injuries, send them to us. And sometimes, but you know, as we've learned during COVID and after, when there are no beds, they won't take them. And that is often. So when the large hospitals buy the small ones, then they don't really feel an obligation to take those patients because there aren't any beds. I saw this over and over again, and many of my colleagues in the specialty just faced this and just were broken by the fact they couldn't transfer the sick to the levels of care that they needed. And I will give some grace to those in the big centers. They didn't have beds and they were overwhelmed also. But this is a system problem. This is not about the physicians and nurses in those places. It's about how we've set it up and in the process neglected the care of those outside the urban areas of America.
Well, one thing I can certainly attest to, when I was a resident, I was surgery resident, I moonlighted up in an area in California called Red Bluff. And the first thing the nurse told me is at 2 in the morning, you're going to get the cowboys. And earlier in the afternoon, you're going to get the snake bites. And the cowboys would be in bar fights. Yeah. And I'd never seen a snake bite in my entire life. You know, they had a whole thing of all these anti-venoms.
Yeah.
And like what you said, sometimes the people get very kind of smart-assy in the academic medical centers. You know, we know it all, we've seen it all, we have it all. But as you said, they've got trauma teams and you're in there all by yourself. And sometimes two people come in and you've got to try to take care of both of them at once. So it's quite a job and it's definitely an unsung heroic job in my mind. I want to ask you kind of go through, you know, you've already said and how I began, these folks are Americans too, and they're good Americans and really nice people. And they aren't just a bunch of dumb, toothless hicks. They're out there growing our corn and zucchinis and cucumbers and tomatoes and all these things that we eat and enjoy and don't even think about our fellow citizens. What are some of the socioeconomic barriers and some of the structural barriers to good medical care out in the country?
You know, actually, I read a fascinating article a couple months ago in the Daily Yonder. I don't know if you have that magazine, but it's printed out of, I think it's associated with the UK. And it talked about the barriers to entry into medicine law that rural students face, because often they don't have good internet access to either prep or take tests and things like that. So for one thing, it's hard for them to get people who are grow up in those areas who want to come back to those areas. And so that's a barrier. And some of those kids are poorer and going into graduate school is expensive. The other thing, of course, is there's a high Medicaid population. These are people who are often poor, generationally poor, and Medicaid is a limit for them. And so finding access to primary care can be daunting. Finding access to specialty care can be nearly impossible when they need something followed up, or they need, I might see them for the fracture and refer them, but that doesn't mean they'll get care beyond maybe even one visit because they're not privately insured. So this happens. This is a problem. Some of their jobs are low paying. Agricultural work is not always lucrative, certainly frequently for those who are on the lower ends of it, who are picking vegetables and fruit and hands and things like that. I think they're also strapped by the economic devastation of the opioid epidemic. I mean, this is called generational poverty. When mom and dad are addicted, whether it's to methamphetamine or heroin or to fentanyl, they don't hold jobs. The kids don't have anything. The kids don't learn how to hold jobs, and the cascade just goes forward. So, you know, I think that's also how we account for what have been called deaths of despair in young males in rural areas, where they just drink or drug themselves to death or are involved in violence because they've just given up. They've stopped trying. And I think that cascade is what causes some of the poverty in rural areas as well. And also there's not a lot of investment, right? People want to invest in those urban and suburban areas that have all the nice things. And when you want people to go to, you want a company to come in, they want to make sure the kids can go to the best schools and have all these wonderful things, which is great. But I think we need to do a better job investing in the infrastructure of rural America, because as you so aptly put, so much of the population is out there. And I think that would help recover so much of what we used to have as a more thriving rural America. Right now, it's just in free fall in so many towns. So it's, you know, it's insurance, it's lack of good jobs, it's drugs. All these things make it difficult for patients to get the care they need. And of course, you can add on to that simply the lack of primary care in those areas, which is just continues to be a problem, even though there are programs trying to bring residents up to go into those areas.
Well, and as you mentioned, having to fly with a regular airplane, somebody from your emergency room to a hospital, the transportation problem must be unbelievable. I mean, if someone's poor, they're not likely to have two cars so somebody can just drive to the doctor while the other person takes the other car that they don't have over to their job.
That's right.
And so it's called priorities. And somebody going to the job ends up taking a higher priority than going to the doctor. You got to earn a living. And folks, I mean, there's certainly a lot of folks all over America who want to earn a living, want to have a job. They don't want to be on welfare. And like you talked about generational poverty and some people not being able to get out of it because of the cost of professional school and college. And these are things that sometimes it bothers me because, you know, the rural areas tend to be red states. And so people make these promises and say they want to help everybody and want equality and equity and diversity. And in my mind, when I think about running into folks who've never seen a real mattress to make a bed, and that to me would add diversity to the medical school class. Not just having people with different skin colors, that's not all there is to diversity. And people need to see that there's bright, intelligent, very interested and curious people who live out in the country. These stereotypes are disgusting, and they, you know, all stereotypes are bad. And these end up affecting medical care. Like they think people don't want it. Like they don't want to go to the dentist or they don't want to go to the doctor. People out in the country are just like anybody else.
And you know, those stereotypes are particularly weaponized during political cycles. And it is disturbing, you know, and I saw this during the peak of the pandemic. It was this sort of tendency to say, well, we wouldn't have a problem if it weren't for those dumb hicks out in the middle of nowhere. It just wasn't true. You know, that was not, there were people who were vaccine hesitant in rural areas than in urban areas, probably actually a little bit more in urban areas. So it was just a nasty politicization. And we've seen this from political leaders in the past who just make terrible invectives about people in flyover country or whatever you want to, whatever words they want to use about them. But they're citizens, and I think it's just reprehensible. I just don't understand it. I would never feel that way about an urban patient if I were working in an urban area. You know, I wouldn't view them that way. I would view them as a human being who needed care, and to take it the other direction is just gross.
Well, it truly is, but somehow that seems to be acceptable, and it boggles my mind. Way back when I was working at Hopkins in Baltimore, we had some families from West Virginia that came up. Some had some familial problems that needed correction and orthopedic surgery. These folks couldn't have been nicer. They didn't have a dime, yet they always brought a little gift for all of us who were taking care of one of the family members. And I'll never forget that, because I think about so many people that we run into that haven't learned Captain Kangaroo's magic words, please and thank you. And these supposed hicks were more polite, more civil than some of the so-called educated urbanites. It's, you know, but like you say, they weaponize it for political reasons.
Right. So, and those people were probably more accepting of diversity than the people at Hopkins were.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I mean, because the poor people accept diversity. That's what I've noticed, you know. I mean, I see so much more of that in rural areas than in other areas, you know. They'll take anybody in there.
That's exactly right. It's that old people are people, and if they need help, they need help, and we don't care anything else. Well, when we come back after the break, we're going to talk about what happens in the ER. Has ER become primary care because of the problems? So I just want to thank everyone for listening to America Out Loud Pulse. We are always a beat ahead. We have free apps on Apple, Android, and Alexa, and you can hear Pulse every weekday at 5 p.m. with an encore at 10 p.m. Eastern. And on iHeartRadio at 8 a.m. the next morning. You can listen on our media player from any web browser anywhere in the world. Now, the best part is all shows go direct to podcast in 24 hours. And the episodes are on a lot of networks. There's Apple, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, Stitcher, and iHeart. So make it easy to listen. Just bookmark AmericaOutloud.com/pulse. The thing I love about Pulse is that there's a different lineup every day. I'm here on Mondays, and then there's Dr. Jordan Vaughn and Dr. Stuart Tankersley, and then we have Dr. Peter McCullough, and he talks with Malcolm Out Loud and takes questions, and Thursdays with Dr. Peter Bregan and Ginger Ross Bregan. And we have a new feature. If you do have questions about a show, just send them in to AmericaOutloud.com/pulse, and we'll see to it that you get an answer.
Hello, I'm Ben Marble, MD, and I founded MyFreeDoctor.com as a donation-supported, faith-based nonprofit with a mission to save lives by delivering free doctor visits to patients in all 50 states of America. MyFreeDoctor.com treats a broad range of health concerns like COVID-19, long COVID, sinus infections, urinary tract infections, rashes, medication refills, and more. So please visit MyFreeDoctor.com, where we're healing America one person at a time.
All right, you've all heard Malcolm and the great Dr. Peter McCullough talk about the povidone iodine-based nasal spray Cofix RX. They talk about it because it's a product that actually works in combating colds, flus, and coronaviruses. Cofix is made in the USA and recommended by thousands of doctors and pharmacists nationwide. It's simple. By attacking viruses where they incubate, you make it easier for your body to heal. Check out the Cofix RX banner ad on AmericaOutloud.com and save 20%. By using promo code OUTLOUD.
Now back to Dr. Lee. I wanted to see, this is something that's happened even in the urban areas where the emergency room has become the new doctor's office. And it's interesting, when Obamacare was passed, that was one of the big things that came up. They said, well, if we have everybody with health insurance, they won't use the emergency room as primary care. And then it turns out in the urban areas, I don't know about rural, that's why you're here, is people used it anyway because they said, quote unquote, it's more convenient. So tell me what happening in the countryside.
You know, the sort of myth is that primary care will be solved by pouring money in, and also the other myth is by putting in nurse practitioners and PAs as primary care providers, right? And that was a goal, and people thought that would really help, and it turns out it hasn't really worked. Those people, when they get their degrees, don't tend to go to rural areas any more than anyone else does. And so a lot of older primary care doctors are retiring, and the need is great. And so these people don't have access to primary care. We talked earlier about financial reasons, but also sometimes it's just logistical in that, A, they can't get there, or B, there just aren't enough slots available, right? Maybe there's one primary care doctor in a town, and the patients will come to me and say, look, I called, my child has a fever. I called my doctor. I've called for 3 days. I can't get an appointment. And, you know, in that case, I can't get upset with it. Why would I? They're doing all they can do to come in to get the care they need for their family. So they come to the emergency department. We become the de facto primary care for so much. And, you know, I don't mind being there. It's just that the problem is they wait a long time and they get a high bill for what they're getting. And it really clogs up the department because people become frustrated. And I understand. Like, you know, I've had this bump on my neck for 2 months. And I had to wait 3 hours in the waiting room. Well, right, because we aren't set up for that. You know, we had a lot of traumas or whatever. We can't do that. So people come to us, and it's amazing to me what they need. Sometimes it's very simple things. I did some telehealth during COVID, during the peak of COVID, and people would call in and say, look, I have asthma. I need to see my primary care doctor. They won't see me, and I can't get them to call me back. I just need an albuterol inhaler. That's all I'm here for. So on telehealth, we would do that. And the same thing happens in the emergency department. It's like, I'm out of my antihypertensive, or I've got this chronic abdominal pain and I can't get follow-up. I need a CT scan and nobody will schedule it. There is that. So of course, some of it is things that are just based on anxiety, people looking on the internet for every little symptom. There is some of that. There's the typical, I've got back pain and I need a work excuse, or I really want some Percocet. There is some of that. But a lot of what we see are people who really just need primary care and don't have access to it. And in addition to that, they need, for instance, addiction care or mental health care, and they can't get in there either. Like, I've tried to get referred to rehab and I can't get there, so I'm here. My mom says I need to be committed for substance abuse or whatever. So those are the things that we see, because there just isn't adequate primary care in rural America. And I don't know what the answer to it is. I mean, I think we need to get, there need to be better financial imperatives for primary care, because people aren't going into it when they can make more money in the specialty. That's just the bottom line. And with med school debt somewhere around, $300,000 right now, it's understandable. They're going to do what they have to do, unless they can get, loan repayment through a federally qualified health center or something like that. They're going to go where the money is. And with that debt load, it's hard to blame them. But right now, the emergency department is the primary care site. And I will tell you right now, it's more and more and more than ever before. I mean, departments are full that in the past would not have been. Early in my career, working in an emergency department, midnight, 2 a.m, it just dried up and nobody came in. You'd put your feet up and tell stories, play cards. Now it is from the time you hit the door to the time you leave, and it's patients lined up and waiting to be seen. And that's not just me. And that's not just urban areas, that's rural hospitals as well, because the need is so great. Some of that's anxiety driven, but a lot of it's just people just don't have the care they need and they're very sick.
Well, why is it that using nurse practitioners and physician assistants hasn't really improved anything?
Well, I think from what I understand, I haven't followed all the data on this, but the idea was they would fill the gap in rural areas. I just don't think they're doing it. I don't think they're going to those places. The other problem is, and I have worked with some wonderful advanced practitioners, when we have a very aging, sick population, and sometimes they're just not, their fund of knowledge and experience is not great enough. I mean, many nurse practitioner graduates are online graduates. They go straight from their RN to their BSN into the online school, and then they're able to practice, but they haven't had the opportunity to do what we did and have a residency and have more mentors and see the sickest of the sick. So when they're thrown in with things, they may not always know what they're seeing, right? That's not because they're bad people or unprofessional or unintelligent. It's just a matter of experience and fund of knowledge. And sometimes when you have a very sick population and you're practicing without someone to help you who's seasoned, that can be difficult. And that's maybe why they don't go to those places, because they will be alone more. And I would understand that. And it's like, it would be like moonlighting in a busy ED your intern year when you knew basically nothing.
Well, that's so true. And one of the things that's happened because of trying to throw in a nurse practitioner or PA in a position where they are on their own is the over ordering of tests, because you don't know the diagnosis, don't have anybody to bounce it off of. And so you order a bunch of tests, not, just for legal reasons to cover your butt, but because you don't know how else to diagnose the person, where someone with more experience might be able to look at the person and just kind of know. I certainly learned that over time in practicing medicine. The more patients you see, the more, in fact, not even just unusual things that you see, the more kind of regular things you see, you get better and better and better at diagnosing it and catching things early instead of late.
Right. Well, I often have said that the practice of medicine is all about the denominator, right? Mm-hmm. It's the total number of patients you've seen. Right.
Well, and it's true. And if you haven't made mistakes, you're making it up, because we all do, and we've all missed something. And hopefully you catch it before the patient suffers greatly from it. Now, you casually just sort of briefly mentioned mental illness. Can you go into that a little bit more? What kind of patients do you see, and how do they come in? Are they in acute episodes, or people who are just seeking help and they have some sort of chronic problem?
Well, we're seeing, of course, post-COVID, mental illness rates went up, particularly among young people. Even before COVID, emergency departments were the screening center for mental illness. So if you were suicidal or something like that, you got taken to the emergency department, and we would work you up and make sure you're medically clear. And then we start calling psychiatric facilities, hopefully with the assistance of a mental health worker or a social worker sometimes, or with telepsychiatry, and they would make recommendations. But oftentimes those patients would come in to sit, and still do, sit for days to weeks waiting on the bed. But it's depression, it's often anxiety, it's frequently bipolar disorder, suicidal behavior, homicidal behavior or thoughts. Sometimes it's frank psychosis. And I believe a lot of that now has to do with stimulants, you know, methamphetamine, in some places cocaine, and also with hallucinogens, because it looks like there's increasing relationship between cannabis and psychosis. That's being found, of course, here and around the world. It always has been known, but it seems worse with possibly with higher levels of THC. So all these things, because these people don't have access to a community mental health clinic, to come to the ED. And if they did show up at the community health clinic and needed to be committed, they would come to the ED because there's no physician there perhaps who would feel comfortable making the assessment or making the decision. And now, of course, everyone has to have a lot of labs to get committed. So you can't go to a psych facility, even if you're young and healthy, unless you've had a metabolic panel, a CBC, a drug screen, a Tylenol level, acetaminophen level, alcohol level. All these things have to be done, even though it's been shown over and over again, those don't make any difference, that they're unnecessary tests. But the screening test is what we have to do. So all these things, whether it's anxiety, depression, suicidality, psychosis, bipolar disorder, all these things come to us, and then they land in the emergency department where we will sedate them a little bit and get a telepsychiatry consult and then wait. And again, it can be a very, very long wait for a bed, And they're boarded. They're not getting therapy. They're getting basically sedated. You know, they might get some Geodon, or they might get some Ativan or something like that at the recommendation of the psychiatrist. But there's not a whole lot happening until they can go elsewhere.
So they're just lying on a gurney in the emergency room?
That's right. In a paper gown, eating, you know, turkey sandwiches with no utensils, and maybe getting to watch TV, maybe. I mean, it's really a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing for them, because it's almost a throwback to ancient times in medicine when people just didn't have a whole lot to offer. I mean, I think there are good psychiatrists out there. It's just these folks don't have access to them while they're in the ED being screened and waiting, you know, to go somewhere else.
Well,
and this is everywhere. I've seen 10, 15 patients waiting in a department that's adjacent to the ED, just waiting for bed. And many of them right now are very young. They're 5, 6, 7, 10, 12, saying, I want to kill myself. And their parents are bringing them in. And they're on, I don't know, already on 3, 4, 5, 6 psychiatric medications. Who knows what's happening to their brain chemistry? I don't know. But somebody's put them on all these medicines and they're suicidal again. And I think all that's tied to what we talked about earlier with, you know, generational poverty and generational social issues and things like that. But that's another discussion altogether.
Well, you know, unfortunately, it has so much to do with the healthcare and what people can do and how people can get out of this, which is something that we have to think about and how we can help our fellow person. You run into some people who say, oh, well, I want to do this or I want to do that. And it's something that's just so outside their financial ability. And then do you rely on the government to do it? Do you have fundraisers? Do you have GoFundMe? Do you have the community get together and say, little Johnny is going to be the first person from our town of 500 that goes to college and everybody pitches in? What do you do?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. I think that, we all know that the old joke about I'm from the government, I'm here to help you. So I think there's a limited capacity of government to do those things. It may just be that bringing reasonable, sustainable jobs back to those areas is the key. And it may take a generation or two, honestly, it just may, until there's stability, until families can succeed more and then they can help their own kids. In the meantime, we've got to do whatever we can to offer scholarships or to offer encouragement to these folks. And maybe you're right, GoFundMe may be an issue. Maybe it would be nice if we could get industries who work in those areas to kind of help with that, right? I mean, there are industries that are a part of that. Think about the Midwest and all those companies that make farm equipment. Maybe they should be coming up with scholarships. And maybe they do. I don't know the answer to that. But if you're dependent on that part of the world for your income, it would make sense to help grow that part of the world, whether it's by funding hospitals or funding education or funding, you know, good internet, anything like that, that would help bring kind of opportunity to those rural communities, which have so little right now.
Well, I think it's very interesting because you mentioned internet, and that for years, all the way back when President Obama was president and talking about, we're going to get internet and we're going to get broadband out to the country. There are areas that barely have what like 20-year-old technology, DSL, that you can, you certainly can't do a Zoom call on it. It talks all slow like this. I mean, there's just no way. And it seems just typical politics, talk. And you wonder, where's the action? Who's actually doing something? And I get so tired of words.
At a certain point, it starts to feel intentional.
Well, you know, I have to agree with you there. I mean, it's this idea, well, like you used the term flyover country earlier, and the fact that that's even a term where you consider 97% of the United States not worth even knowing about or thinking about, or, you know, it's so arrogant, and the people are suffering. So when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about mental illness, just because of some of the things that you were describing and having people have to come sit in the ER. My husband had chest pain, and that happened to him. He sat in the hallway with a pulse oximeter that was broken, you know, for I don't know how many hours. And I can't imagine somebody with a complaint of mental illness. So we'll talk about that some more on the other side of the break. I just want to thank everyone for listening to America Out Loud Pulse. We are always a beat ahead.
You already know Genesis plus HOCL is your best defense against viruses. But did you also know it's the most powerful weapon for eliminating airborne mold, too? Customers are raving about the Genesis Fogger's ability to tackle mold problems and the bad smells that go with them. And we all know mold is a hazard to your health. There's no airborne invader that Genesis can't handle. Visit genesisfogger.com/outloud to receive a 15% discount on the Genesis Fogger with promo code OUTLOUD. With Genesis, you're ready for anything.
Oral hygiene hasn't changed in 50 years, but our diet and the way we eat has, creating an environment in your mouth for bacteria to wreak havoc on your teeth and gums. For better oral health, get Spry Dental Defense, an oral care line designed to combat acid-creating bacteria. The toothpaste, mouthwash, mints, and gum all contain xylitol, a natural ingredient shown to dramatically improve oral health. Spry can be found online and at all fine natural retailers.
We've got free apps on Apple, Android, and Alexa. You can hear Pulse every weekday at 5 with an encore at 10 p.m. That's Eastern Time. And on iHeartRadio the next morning at 8 a.m. You can listen on our media player from any web browser anywhere in the world. And the best part for me, because I'm not always available at 5 p.m. Eastern, is the shows go direct to podcast in 24 hours. Lots of podcast networks carry us. Apple, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, Stitcher, and iHeart. So make it easy. Bookmark AmericaOutloud.com. Now, the lineup changes every day. I'm on Monday, and we have Tuesdays with concerned doctors, Dr. Jordan Vaughn and Dr. Stuart Tankersley. And then we have Dr. Peter McCulloch, and he teams up with Malcolm Out Loud, and they take questions. And of course, they talk about COVID. And then Dr. Peter Bregan and Ginger Ross Bregan. Dr. Bregan is an incredible psychiatrist. And in fact, he's one of the people that has talked so much about the problem in steering people toward good mental health. And he's one of the people, well, the person who busted wide open frontal lobotomies, that we do not cut into people's brains for mental health issues. So that's a very exciting show. And then we have our new feature for questions. We don't have on-air question and answer capability, but if you send in a question to americaoutloud.com/pulse, we will see to it that you get an answer. So I'm going back with Dr. Leap for a minute on this mental health issue. And what made me think about it is the recent shootings and the laws proposed for gun violence and red flag laws and all that. And I'm hearing you talk about the situation of folks coming in. It's like, no wonder parents aren't bringing their adult child into the ER if they're not going to get any help. And they quietly try to take care of this person themselves, or who knows what they're thinking. And then the next thing you know, there's some sort of an outburst. And sadly, sometimes it is a shooting. What I just don't know. What do you think we can do about this problem?
About the mental health problem or the violence problem?
Well, kind of both. They're intertwined, because we can't blame everything on mental health, but so many things do come back to mental health.
Yeah. Now, I don't know. I tell you what I think. First of all, I think we need a return to the idea of the psychiatric hospital, right? After the 60s, we started closing psychiatric hospitals. And I think we need more again, because there are people who simply can't function on their own, right? And they take up a lot of our time, because they are homeless because of schizophrenia or some other issue, or maybe they had a stroke and they were very poor. They just can't function anymore. I don't know, maybe drug abuse, maybe alcoholism. At any rate, they need a place to live safely. Because I listened to a podcast recently, and the speaker who had been involved at the federal level through the White House with homelessness said that about 80% of the homeless population is either related to drug abuse or mental illness. And I think that probably is true. That makes sense to me. So we have people who should be taken off the street for their own good, because they come back over and over again, poor, cold, sick, their diabetes isn't managed, they're abused, they're beaten. So that's a population, that's a subset. For the rest of it, I think we need community mental health centers. I think we need almost Manhattan Project size effort to get people to be counselors, psychiatrists, mental health social workers, mental health nurses. I mean, I can't do this. It's not my sort of bailiwick, right? But I'm happy to help. I'm happy to do what I can from my standpoint. But these people need access to care. And what we get right now, I think, if you look at a mental health consultation, a telepsych consultation, it's almost always an adjustment medication. And there are people who need that. But a lot of what these folks need, the people, particularly depressed and anxious folks, is they really need therapy. They need, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy. They need someone to talk about their issues. They need to deal with their PTSD. And drugs are part of that, but not all of it, right? They need someone to get this off their chest. They may be grieving. They may be veterans who are struggling with PTSD. And the VA can do some of that, but not all of it. So we need just so much more. I mean, I hate to keep saying, it sounds very tired to say we need more of something, but we do. We have a huge population of mental illness, and we need the resources to care for them. And the answer can't just be, well, it's 5 o'clock, this is difficult, go to the ER, they'll figure it out. Because we don't do a very good job of that. And that's important for most people like me to remember, and we say this. In the same way as I don't feel comfortable managing, you know, a sepsis patient who's hypotensive for 3 days, I'm not an intensivist. I don't feel comfortable managing a bipolar break or something like that for days or weeks on end. I don't do a good job of that. We need people who will do a good job of that. And we need people in the community who will interdict that, identify these things, and get folks pointed in the right direction to psychiatry early rather than late, right? I think the wrong thing is to say we just got to medicate more people. That's not the only answer. It has to be a systems issue. And violence is related to that. I think violence is related to mental illness. Violence is related to bad home life and abuse, right? Violence is related to drug use. There's no question about it. Violence related to not only the drug trade, but also drug use. There are plenty of people who are violent when they're on stimulants, and evidence suggests there are people who are violent when they're psychotic from hallucinogens, right? This is an issue. And the psychotic people are not just nice people who are safe. They may be very nice people, but they're also potentially dangerous. And people get attacked in the ED all the time. We could talk a long time about the pathetic state of security in most hospitals. And it's really horrible, unless you're in a big center. There's next to nothing. So what do we do with that? I mean, if the system wants all this to flow to the ED, then we need to make changes that make that work. So every ED needs to have some primary care clinic follow-up available. Every ED needs to have a couple of therapists and a psychiatrist available. These are things we ought to do so that every place can do the right thing rather than just say, well, go there and they'll sort through the next couple of weeks. That's unfair to the patients. And it's certainly unfair to the staff when you have nurses who are doing their best to manage the traumas and heart attacks and also trying to manage the demented patient wandering the hall for 3 days or the psychotic patient who's threatened the staff and gets his hand around the neck of the nurse. That happens all the time. And then what happens is when someone leaves, they didn't watch or something bad outcome happens, someone from administration shows up with a clipboard and says, so we see you violated the policy. Why didn't you do the right thing? Well, because I had 26 patients. Well, no. We need to explain what happened. I just did. I can't take care of these things at the staffing ratios I have. And then someone's in trouble, right? And this is how this goes like this all the time. Or someone pushes back against a violent patient and they get fired because they defend themselves.
Well, one of the things that you said that I know I had a friend in the Navy and where she was stationed, they were trying to do this, is have psychiatric follow-up right on the spot near internal medicine offices so people don't have the stigma. It's like, just go down the hall, you can see Dr. So-and-so. And in the emergency room, the idea of having a follow-up doctor right there in the emergency room, since the person's already made the drive to the emergency room, they can follow up with somebody right there on the spot and take whatever you did as your initial diagnosis and take it further and then try to make some sort of arrangement, whether it be telehealth or, you know, something else, some group situation. I mean, there's this whole problem. I mean, I'm not a mental health professional, and sometimes I think all doctors are at heart, because everybody has problems other than their physical problem. But they started this new suicide prevention. What is it? It's 988. Well, it turns out most of the country doesn't even have a center that if you dialed 988, there's nobody staffing the center to do anything about it.
Right.
And that's so typical.
Great idea, but maybe that could work. Yeah. That's funny. Sad, but funny.
Yeah, I know, but it's so expected and typical. Well, I'm going to ask you a bit about maternal health. Do you have a lot of women, and I will use the word women, who come in and you caught me there, and haven't seen anyone, not a doctor, not even their sister, who had a baby before, and they popping in and popping out a baby right on the gurney?
Well, fortunately, the places I've worked, I've not seen a lot of that, but there are people who will come in with, you know, with labor, even though there's another facility maybe 10 minutes further down the road that does have OB, and they'll say, well, I just want to get checked here. Like, you know, you're having contractions. Well, I know. But your obstetrician is 10 minutes further down the road. Well, I know, but I wanted to come here. So part of that is explaining to people, and I wish hospitals do a better job of this, to say, look, if you're in labor, here's where the people around you have labor and delivery. And many of the places, I can't think of a place in the last couple of years I worked that actually had labor and delivery, right? I mean, so that's frightening. So I had a call from EMS last year. I was working at a small hospital in South Carolina. It had nothing. It's a critical access hospital. EMS said, we're coming in. We're 10 minutes out, 26-week pregnant patient with contractions. I said, you know, on the phone, I said, you know, we don't have anything here. And they said, well, we just thought it'd be safer to bring her there. 10 minutes further, literally, was a big hospital with labor and delivery and the NICU and all that. But they decided, because it was faster, to come to me. And then the patient didn't want to listen to me, and the patient signed on AMA. It was just a disaster. So that's the sort of thing that a lot of places, you know, do not have. And yet people still get pregnant and they still don't get the prenatal care they need in the community. And so they'll just show up because they don't understand. I mean, the truth is, people think a hospital is a hospital is a hospital, right? A doctor is a doctor is a doctor. Every hospital has obstetrics, right? Every hospital has a heart surgeon. On TV, they all do. And we don't explain to people adequately that you need to go to the place where you have the resources you need. And if it's an emergency, it's an emergency. But if you think, I've got a couple contractions, I need to go to a place that has it. But as you said, many people don't even know, or if they did know, they're not even really interested in it. And some of those folks have mental illness or addiction issues and things like that, and they don't do well.
Well, and I think those addiction
hospitals have had their.
No, I was going to say those addiction issues might keep somebody away because they're afraid that they'll get turned in.
And also, a lot of these small hospitals have had their obstetrics care pulled out from them by private equity. Right? Or by larger systems. Like, you don't need OB. It's too expensive. Well, okay, but a couple of bad outcomes are pretty expensive too.
Well, it's interesting, and I'm glad you brought up private equity again. There's been recent articles about some of these small hospitals that have been bought up by people who have no experience in hospitals. They're looking at it just like an investment. It could be widgets for all they care. And people running the new hospital don't have experience. They certainly don't have experience in rural areas and don't know what they're doing. They lose money. They don't have enough money for the drugs that the doctors want. And suddenly the hospital falls apart. And so then the people are stuck with, okay, well, we've got a building here. We've got some basics. Is it better to have this? Or is it better to close this substandard place?
Right. And I don't know what the right answer is. I suspect a lot of these places would be better off if private equity turned them into freestanding EDs with a couple observation beds and then made better arrangements with the referral centers. But I don't know. I don't know. I mean, it could be long transports for those people. But it's not helping. It's not helping to pull services out of these communities. But it is helping them in their tax write-off or whatever else they're doing with it. This is not they're not buying these hospitals because they have some humanitarian impulse. It's purely financial, as you know.
Exactly. And that's the problem, because medicine, yes, everyone wants to make a living. And I think it's silly to think that we don't deserve to get paid for our work. But when you have somebody who's not even a healthcare professional and not any connection to the community or anything, just an outside moneymaker, that's where you kind of have to draw the line. And even the feds are starting to look at some of these purchases, because as you know, the purchasing of large urban hospitals is getting out of control, to where we're going to end up with two named hospitals in the entire United States. I mean, it already happened to the insurance companies. There used to be 804 health insurance policies out there from different carriers. Now we've got about six carriers that just give regular old health insurance. I hate to see that happening with the hospitals, where everything is a part of Sutter or this health or that health. And you know, even though they're different hospitals, there's still no competition, because it's Big Brother is running the whole thing. They all have to use the same meds. They all have to use the same algorithms, et cetera, et cetera.
They all go to the same meetings. They all belong to the same clubs. This is not, there's no variety there. It's like a big game of Risk, you know. It's like geopolitics written in medicine.
That's exactly right. And it's you know, it's sad to me because we know we need to make some changes. And then everybody says, oh, well, let's have single payer. Let's have the government pay for it all. And then major eye roll, look at the VA, how, you know, the VA, how did the VA improve? By letting the veterans go to private practitioners. And something we have to do is encourage, you said this earlier, and I'll say it again, encourage people to go to primary care and encourage people to go to areas that they have been told are less desirable. If anybody would actually go and see some of the beautiful country and the lovely family-oriented people. I was talking to a worker in West Virginia who had a better paying job. He was working something with precious metal mining. And he said, but I had to go to work at 1:30 in the morning and I never saw my family. So, you know, when was the last time I heard somebody care about their family? So they went to a lesser paying job. And, you know, it's just crazy. And people, the stigmatization of country folk just has to stop. And I think we'll get some better care, better doctors, and have some of the country folk themselves actually get to medical school. I want to thank you for coming on the show, because people don't talk about this much, but it's something that has bothered me. It's interested me. And I'd love to talk to you again. You know so much about so many areas. Tell me you'll come back.
I would be delighted, because I feel like this is my, this is an issue I'm passionate about. And I feel like I'm the weeping prophet just talking about this, saying we've got to fix this problem. And I'm trying to get more people to pay attention to the issue. So I really appreciate your time and the opportunity to be here.
Well, please give me and the audience your website so they can read some of the wonderful things you've written.
Great. So my main website is www.edwinleap.com. Simple.
And then that's LEAP.
That's correct.
Okay.
And then also I've started writing at Substack. And so my Substack address is edwinleap.substack.com. And my column is titled Life and Limb.
Oh, great. Well, thank you very much. And again, I'm just so glad you came on the show. And I learned a lot, and I know the listeners did too. And to my listeners, thank you for listening to America Out Loud Pulse. You know, we are always a beat ahead. You can hear Pulse every weekday at 5 with an encore at 10 p.m. and on iHeartRadio at 8 a.m. the next morning. You can listen on our media player from any web browser anywhere in the world. And all shows go direct to podcast in 24 hours. And we're on a lot of networks: Apple, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, Stitcher, iHeart. So make it easy. Bookmark AmericaOutLoud.com/pulse. And remember, we now have a new feature, and that's you can ask questions. You can send them in to AmericaOutLoud.com/pulse and ask the question, whether the host or the guest, and we'll see to it that you get an answer. So whether you agree or have other opinions, please share the show. And thank you for listening. Until next week, say it loud. I'm free and I'm proud.